We've worked with this influencer had around 5 million YouTube subscribers in a niche that is one of the biggest niches of all. By all accounts, you think this is surely a dead cert. We couldn't sell a thing.
Hello, and welcome to the Art of Selling Online Courses. We're here to share winning strategies and secret hacks from top performers in the online course industry. My name is John Ainsworth. And today's guest is Ollie Richards. Now, Ollie had a series of random careers from jazz musician to English teacher before eventually starting a blog on his passion, language learning. And he grew it into a $10 million online business. Today, he writes a newsletter at ollierichards.co, teaching other online entrepreneurs how to scale their businesses to seven plus figures using story learning as a living case study. Now, before we dive into our interview with Ollie today, Josip is our funnel strategy lead, and he's worked on dozens of funnel building and optimization projects. He's developed and tested most of the systems that we use here at Data Driven Marketing when we're working with our clients. And we took all of Josip's training that he's ever done and we transcribed it and we uploaded it to a AI coach system. It's called CoachVox. And it's built by this pair, Jody and Ben Cook. And they built this amazing system. So you can take ChatGPT and on top of it, you can layer a coach's ability, all of the stuff they've covered in their training before, and make like a super version of ChatGPT. And what we've done is taken all of that, we've made it available for free. So if you go to datadrivenmarketing.ai, you can access Josip AI, and he's going to help you to understand how to improve and build your funnel. So go check it out. I hope it's useful. Let me know what you think. Ollie, welcome to the show, man. Thanks very much for joining us.
It is an absolute pleasure. Good to see you, John.
With your course business, let's get into that first. Who do you help and what kind of problem are you solving for them?
My course business is storylearning.com, and we teach foreign languages through stories. And specifically, we help people who have English as a first language or an operating language, and we help them learn other languages. So for example, someone in the UK or the US who wants to learn Spanish, we will help them do that. And using stories is our USP. It's what makes us different. It's how we, you know, what we call out in our marketing and everything like that.
So where did that come from? How did you come up with that idea in the first place of using stories?
When I first started the business back in 2013, it wasn't even a business. It was a blog. You know, I was stuck in a job I wasn't enjoying in the Middle East, and I needed a creative outlet of some kind. So I decided blogging on my passion, which has always been language learning. It was just me talking about my ideas. It wasn't until 2019, I think, a full 6 years later, it could even have been 2020, I lose track of the years sometimes, but It wasn't until then that we actually fully rebranded to storylearning.com, and we actually doubled down on that angle. And I always like to mention that because you know how you always get this advice of, well, you have to niche down, you have to have a USP. It took me like a full 6 years to actually properly figure that out, you know, and I always found that really difficult. And that really came through, you know, I'd always been told you have to have a unique angle, I have to have a unique USP, but I wasn't sure what it was. And it wasn't until after a few years of running my blog that I actually started to think, actually, you know what, I actually have this way of learning languages that I haven't really talked about that much. Let's try out a few things, see if it resonates. And so I started off by writing and self-publishing some books of short stories. They really took off, ended up getting a book deal out of it, and they got published in the shops, and you know, did super well. People loved them. And I said, okay, well, how can we expand on this? So I've made my first course that did really well. And then we spent the next 3 or 4 years just building out tons of courses all around this concept that had been kind of proven to work. It had the advantage of being something that I'd done myself, but also something that really resonated with the market, or with my audience at least. And so it was kind of a sort of slow, gradual creep in that direction until it got to the point where I kind of realized, all right, we can't be dancing around this any longer. Let's do a full-on rebrand. Let's put our money where our mouth is. So we did a big rebrand, we did a 301 redirect on the website, which was terrifying because, you know, a million visitors a month, you know, your SEO, what's going to happen? It was full-on terrifying, but we did it and ended up with a nice, clean brand business all aligned around stories.
So what does it look like What's the kind of, if somebody's interested in learning a language and they want to learn it in the story learning way, what does that mean?
Yes, good question. So if you think back to when you learned languages at school, most people have a similar kind of recollection. So it's lists of words, it's learning grammar rules, it's very kind of learning by rote, old-fashioned stuff. And most modern language apps actually follow a similar principle. The reason is that it's quite convenient to write software algorithms that test you on, did you get this right or did you get it wrong? Does this word mean carrot or does it mean apple? So a lot of apps like Duolingo are kind of based on this same principle. When you learn with story learning, you learn with stories, not rules. That's the kind of tag that I always use. And the reason is that stories are the most, you know, the oldest form of human communication. This is how everything is conveyed, passed down through generations through stories. And so what we do is we get you reading stories in the language from day one. They're very simple stories, but stories nonetheless. And so we immerse you in the language through stories, and then you kind of uncover the rules of the language, the grammar and the vocabulary as you go. So it's kind of upside down, but it resonates with people, I think, because on an intuitive level, it makes sense to people that language is learned through stories. So, you know, I think that's why it tends to land quite well with people.
And do you reckon it's like how many people are learning a language? Do you think if they heard about your system would be like, or they tried it, would be like, oh yeah, this is brilliant. Is it just that you managed to find your audience who like that kind of thing? Or is it, this is fundamentally a better way of doing it?
Yeah, so there's the marketing and then there's the truth, right? So the truth is, you know, with my language hat on, the single best way to learn a language is the way that works for you and that you've and that you've discovered, right?
It's like whatever the best workout is, the one that you actually
exactly do, you right? know, the only bad workout is the one that you miss, right? It's like that, and you know, many of my friends who are serial language learners, they all learn in totally different ways. Yeah. Everybody, you know, some people like are big into flashcards and memorization. Other people, they just go on the street and start speaking to people randomly. Other people love grammar. So, but the thing is that you're talking about accomplished high performers in this scenario, right? Most people are not that. Most people who are learning a language they don't know what they're doing. They find it very difficult and they need help. So typically we cater to people that, one of the lines that I use at story learning is what you do when you've tried everything else and you're finally ready to learn. So you might, so a typical student might be someone that's been messing around on Duolingo for 6 months, has realized that it's a waste of time and is now actually ready to put some work in to finally learn Spanish or French or Japanese. And so, that's who we cater to. It's not the, you know, if Duolingo, who apparently have 500 million users of their app, if Duolingo caters to the masses, we're kind of the next level down where it's like, right, once you've kind of got it out of your system and you're finally ready to learn, our stuff is going to be a challenge, but it's going to work. And so that's kind of how we approach it.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because like we know a lot of people who teach languages in different ways, right? So if you take Lydia, with language mentoring, I think is her site.
Yeah,
I forget.
That's right.
The exact URL. But I think, if I remember right, and she'll tell me off for this because we've had long conversations about it, but like I think her method is try and figure out whatever system works for you. It's like, it's almost more that than here's a method of how you actually go about doing it. Because she said the same thing, right? She knows loads of polyglots and they've all got a different way of learning languages. You know, you see Benny and he's like, so I saw Benny out in Benny Lewis out in Mexico, and he hadn't been traveling for ages, and all of a sudden he was traveling again and he was so excited because he's like, nearly the whole conference he's missing all the sessions because he's out in the market talking to Mexicans and like learning Mexican style Spanish and trying things out and what have you, and he loves that. And most people would find that terrifying.
Yep.
To go out and just go to a market and be bad at the thing. And it's like, oh my God, that sounds awful. And then some people love your method of like how you do it. And it's really interesting, like that kind of, you found a specific angle that works for a group of people. Whereas probably Duolingo is like, okay, they've gone with the absolute common denominator that works for the most people, or doesn't work maybe in a bunch of cases, you know, but appeals to the most people, is kind of the most normal.
I see a lot of different education businesses, as I know you do as well. And there are, I tend to think of there being two main approaches to content. One is meta, and one is instructional. So meta would be how to do something. For example, this is you mentioned Lydia, where she helps people find the best way for them to learn. This is very much a meta approach. So this is how to think about learning, how to discover the system that works best for you. It's extremely meta. An instructional approach, on the other hand, is do this, then do that, then do this, then do that. Now, most people in the world are not systems thinkers. Most people are, they don't particularly take an interest in that, in the hows, whys, wherefores. They need a step-by-step path. Do this, then do that, then do this. So I started in the early days of my business, I was also very meta. My first language course that I ever made was called Language Learning Foundations. And this was, it was a 10-part course. Here are my tips and tricks for learning a language. This was the meta. And it did fine, because I had a small but engaged audience. But what I found was, as soon as I went out to start running paid ads, for example, reaching a wider audience of people who were encountering me for the first time, they would get my course on how to learn a language, and they'd be like, yeah, but where are the words? Where's the grammar? Where's the? And I said, no. I'm sort of telling you how to learn. And then, no, give me a refund. So I very quickly realized that what product market fit looks like to the masses is very different to what product audience fit looks like. As in, you know, if you can cultivate a very sort of passionate small group of fans who will hang off your every word, that what you do for them typically doesn't scale out to a more mass market approach. So I've very deliberately gone down the path of designing something that Joe blogs on Main Street in Central Oregon, who's never learned Spanish before, can pick up and use from day one and doesn't need to start thinking in all these meta terms.
That's really interesting. So Christopher Sutton, who's been on the podcast before, you know Christopher, right?
I don't know. I know the name, but I that's about it.
He doesn't come out anymore. Christopher Sutton runs... He really should. I need to convince him. He runs a site called Musical You. I think the site is musical-you.com. And he's teaching people musicality. He's teaching people... How can you become more what you think of as naturally musical? So he's teaching people how to play music by ear, how to be able to hear the music and play it without having to go through the process in between of, you know, find somebody who's already transcribed it, written out all the notes, learn all the notes. It's like there's a step where you can become what people think of as a virtuoso. But he's like, there are a series of steps to get there. But that's too far from where most people are.
Yeah.
When he's running ads, he doesn't sell that product. When he's running ads, he's selling something that's like teaching a much more simple entry-level mass market thing, getting people in, and then explaining his message, explaining his concept through email and video over time, and then saying, if you want to upgrade and you want to go get the full package, this is available. And so I really see that's really interesting, that kind of way to think about what is it that you can take out to the masses? How mass do you need it to be? Because all of us have got these relatively niche businesses compared to Duolingo or something like that, right? Yeah. But you can't be too niche. So I kind of finding that's really interesting.
It is a big danger to be too niche, you know. And I think it all comes. There's no right or wrong here. It all comes down to knowing the game that you're playing, essentially. And I think a lot of the time people. We often fall into these businesses by accident, don't we? I mean, I certainly did. I'm not sure in your case, but certainly certainly creators do. You know, anyone who identifies as a creator started off making content, realized there's a business behind it, ended up, you know, monetizing and finds themselves with a big business on their hands, but have never really thought about the fact that, hey, maybe being a personal brand has its limitations. Maybe my meta products over here that teach my topic to a very kind of high level for the experts, maybe that's not what everybody wants. And so, you know, you kind of have to go through this process of actually reimagining your whole business in order to create something that can scale further, because you're scaling a business requires all different elements of your business to be able to scale, the marketing, the finance, but also the product. And the product has to be something that can scale beyond your immediate audience. And you know, that's essentially what I did 5-6 years in. I realized, hang on, this is what I have here currently is not going to fly with the wider market. And if I want to grow, I'm gonna have to rejig things and move things around. So yeah, it's a big deal.
Talk to me about the audience, because you said, you know, you were very niche and you need to expand, but you had this, did you say 1 million website visitors a month?
Yeah.
That's a lot. You know, most people are not at that level, right? We know a couple of people who are past that with these kind of language businesses. How did you manage to build that audience up? Was it all through blogging?
Yeah. So I started off blogging. 2013, blogging was a big deal. YouTube wasn't really, I mean, it was a thing, but it wasn't a thing, you know.
Yeah.
And podcasts have started, but, you know, podcasts are very hard to grow, very hard to build large audiences unless you're in a very, very, you know, big area, or you're one of the, a lot of the big podcasts started in the mid 2000s and managed to keep their first positioning over the years. I also enjoyed writing, so I started off blogging, and the thing that I did right was I kept it up. So you know, after a couple of years, I was getting 30,000-50,000 people a month to the website. I saw there was traction. When things really started taking off on multiple levels, but including on website traffic, was when I began to hire a team and to build a team, because I was the bottleneck, right? So my job for the first 2 years was every week, write a blog post, publish it. But I would spend like 10 hours writing my blog posts because I had the creator mentality at that time, right? I'm going to make the best damn piece of content I can on this topic. So I would write it, and I would spend just as long making it look pretty on WordPress before publishing it. As soon as I started to shift and I hired a blog manager who would be responsible for actually writing it up on WordPress and publishing it. And then we started to hire writers who would actually create the content in the first place. As soon as I got myself out of the equation, then we started to release 2-3 blog posts a week. We then started working with SEO people who helped us kind of redesign the site structure so that it was Google friendly. We then took more of a keyword approach to building. And so we just did the fundamentals well and kept it up for years and years and years.
And what's that converted to? And if there's any of these numbers you don't want to share, then just say and move on. But what has that converted to in terms of email list size?
So we, as of today, I believe our email list is around 150,000 people. Okay. We quite proactively cull the list. So, you know, every 3 months we tend to remove 15,000-20,000 people. To a certain extent, I'm plucking these numbers out of thin air because I don't do this myself anymore. But, you know, we quite aggressively cut. So, you know, we would have, 150 odd thousand people and we'd have open rates of around 40%. To broadcast, so it's a relatively engaged list.
Yeah, that's good. 40% strong.
Yeah, it's what's happened recently though in the last year, because we've been running a lot of paid traffic, that's slightly been decreasing for obvious reasons. But then as long as we keep up the aggressive cleaning of the list to make sure that only the most engaged people stick, then you know that keeps the quality up. So you know I came from a very kind of old school online business background where you build a list, you really nurture the relationship with that list, you take care of it, you practice good list hygiene, which is a terrible term, but it's but it's what you do. So you know, it's I feel grateful that I got schooled in these online business fundamentals back then, because I think a lot of people now, you know, my big kind of criticism of the creator economy is that everyone kind of gets through the door and they get started, but they tend to think that the source to everything they want in life is AdSense and brand deals.
Oh,
and so they never.
Oh, it upsets me so much, Ollie. Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm preaching to the choir. But as a result, they never learn fundamentals, right? They don't understand list building. They don't understand nurturing relationship with your list. They think email is something from the 1990s. So from having learned this thing at a good point in time, I've always had pretty good fundamentals with email, and that's also what's allowed us to build the systems that sell very effectively on the back end as well. But these things take years to learn and to hone.
Do you know about how many new email subscribers you get a month from the? Is it still at 1 million a month, the website?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I don't check it that often. Our website traffic has been, I see a lot of growth curves which look like hockey sticks. Ours has never been like that. If you looked at our growth curve, you'd just see one flat. It's up and to the right, but it's very smooth. You've got random fluctuations, over time, when you look on a 10-year view, it's just one very long gradual growth curve.
Yeah.
And what I take from that is that we've done a good job with content, because I know a lot of people who have been hammered by various Google updates and things.
Yeah.
We've never had that problem. And I can only surmise from that it's because Google likes our content. But then also over time, what's happened is that, we get a lot of traffic from other places now. So we have affiliates that send traffic. We have we have over 25 books in the shop. So people pick up our books and come over. We've grown a big YouTube channel now, and that's growing all the time. That sends people over. So our reliance on Google is less and less now. And so that also sort of smooths out the curve. But yeah, I mean, it's in the range of 1 million a month, give or take 20%.
Mm. And do you know how many new email subscribers you get, or is that one of the numbers that you're not sure?
Now, because we run so much paid traffic, the numbers are getting kind of polluted. So we would get anywhere from like 300 to 500 emails a day. A large amount of those would be from paid. At least half of those would be from paid. And a certain number of those wouldn't remain on the list for very long because they'd either unsubscribe or we'd clean them off. So, I've stopped. It's been some time now that I've stopped paying that much attention to, this is a whole topic of itself, so you can let me know if you want to go down this road, but I tend not to look so much at the kind of the unit economics of email from an organic perspective. It's much more in terms of kind of cost to acquire those emails than versus, what comes out in revenue on the other end. And yes. sometimes you'll be paying more for leads, sometimes you'll be paying less. We're just about to go into Black Friday, so costs are going to be through the roof. And then something else, something will happen. We'll have another pandemic, God forbid, and then prices will go through the floor. So, cost for everything goes up and down, but it's, I tend to look more at the kind of the big numbers on either end rather than trying to get an LTV from individual emails.
What's the process like for you guys around how do you actually convert someone once they're on your list into buying from you? Are you doing launches? Are you doing promotions? Is it like evergreen? Have you got stuff that's done manually? What's kind of structure for you?
Yeah, so it's a big fat mix of lots of stuff. So fundamentally, if we just take a step back, so my way of conceiving the business is in terms of an ecosystem. So whereas lots of people have a value ladder, everyone's heard this term before, where the aim is essentially to kind of sell people gradually up from your cheapest thing to your higher thing. Our way of approaching email and selling is that we say, you're learning a language. It's going to take, you're going to be doing this for a number of years. We want to be part of your journey throughout that time. There's no such thing as a secret that we can sell you now that's going to help you learn in a month. It's going to take you time. So we want to be on that journey with you. So as such, the main approach we take is to make regular offers at different points in time. And so a lot of our LTV comes from people who will buy something on today and then buy the next level in 6 months and then maybe buy a bundle of packages later on in the year and then maybe buy a couple more courses the next year. We have a big ecosystem of products that we kind of cross-sell and upsell and so on and so forth. So that is the that's the kind of ethos. And so from that, we then say that, okay, if the aim is to maximize customer value over a longer period of time, then it follows that our principal aim from our marketing is to nurture and grow those relationships. So what we try to do is to, we spend a lot of money on content marketing. So there's blogs, there's podcasts, this is YouTube videos. And then we will market that internally. So people on the email list will receive that content that in turn strengthens the relationship. And then we have a general cadence of two offers per month. So we will have a mid-month offer and an end-of-month offer. And those offers will change. Sometimes they're kind of programmed out for a whole year. Sometimes we have new initiatives. More recently, we've been selling a lot of higher ticket stuff, for example. So we inject new things, certain promotions and products get retired, other new ones get brought in. So it's essentially a cadence of two promos a month, buffeted in between large amounts of great content, what we like to think of as great content that we send out to people over the course of time. And so as such, we have people that have been buying from us for 6, 7, 8 years, literally that long. And that, I think that kind of contributes to that relatively flat growth curve that I spoke about before, because so much of the, you know, revenue we might make this year will come from audience that we've acquired 2, 3, 4 years earlier and who are still buying from us, you know. So that's conceptually, that's how I think of things. I also have a kind of penchant for stability and slow, stable growth. That's kind of how I like to do things. So I very much lean into that. So that's how we approach it kind of procedurally. But then on the front end, we do have a fairly robust automated sequence as well, because you know, marketing principles, a large number of people who join your list are interested now. And so you do have to sell them now, because if you don't, you'll miss that opportunity. You also want to offer things to people so that they have access to the help if they want it, because if not, they'll just run off to your competitor to buy. So what we do is we have essentially 3 months of emails, of automated sequences that get sent out, daily emails, with only the occasional couple of days off, maybe after a promotion. And then in those emails, essentially we are doing one of three things. We are either telling stories, we are sending them out to our best content, and then we are promoting stuff. And we've structured that in a way that you know, we've kind of figured out what makes sense over time. And I'm happy to talk about it if you want to go into more depth. But we have that 2.5, 3 month automated process at the start, which is where a good chunk of that revenue comes from.
Nice. And what's the, you've got this whole new, I don't know, maybe not that new, but like a separate venture going on, right? Where you work with people who don't have courses yet, but have got an audience. Can you talk to people about that? Like what you've been doing with that? Because that's been fascinating to watch.
Yeah. So the business is called Creator Empires, and I run it with Jan, my business partner. And the reason we got into this was essentially because we had so much experience. I mean, you know what this is like, right? You have a certain amount of experience doing something, and then you want to start to apply that to something beyond your immediate surroundings. Your immediate sphere of influence. And more and more as time went on, we found that we had people come into us, at first people from the language space who already knew about us, saying, you know, well, how do you do this? How do you do that? And so we started to help people. Initially, we started to run events, then we did little retreats and things. And eventually we started to have people come into us who would say, so someone with a large YouTube channel, for example, who couldn't care less about courses, doesn't want to make them. They're not educators. They're not the kind of person who's going to make a course. But they come to us and say, you know what? I kind of think it makes sense for my business to have courses. And we'd say, yep, it would. and you could probably add a fairly easy 6-7 figures to your top line with courses. And they'd say, right, well, I'm not going to do it myself, so could you just do it for me? And we'd say, yes, we can. And so we sort of set about doing that. And it's been great because we kind of understand how to do these things in a, it doesn't have to be fancy at all. It's often quite simple, actually, the way to implement this stuff. But relatively simply, we can build programs for people so that they can monetize their existing audience with courses. And so, that's been growing now in one form or another for about 3 or 4 years. And it's most of all, I'd say, and you're going to understand this because this is your bread and butter, but it's just super fascinating to see the dynamics of other businesses and how they work and to see how different businesses perform because it's a big world out there. And, you know, you've got people who you think are going to be absolute knockout superstars, but then it completely flops. And then the opposite, people with an audience that you think, oh, there's not much to this, who then have, you know, massive buying power within that audience. So it's been very interesting to kind of watch and learn about other people's businesses as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one because from the way we get around it is we only work with people who are already selling courses and they're already selling.
Yeah.
Because it's much so smarter. Hard You're to figure it out. Well, it's a much smaller audience though, right? In some ways, your model has got way more potential from a business point of view because you could take like this whole percentage of the business for, you know, a long time. It's a whole new thing. But it's so hard to figure out in advance. You look at an audience, you're like, oh, yeah, this is a no-brainer.
Yeah.
This audience is an audience who buys courses. We've seen other people in this niche sell courses and do great with it. And then you get somebody in that, you know, you get that person who's got that big audience of a, you know, 1 million website visitors a month or a 2 million person YouTube channel, whatever. And we've worked with people and they've started making these things and then it's not done great. And you're like, why? And I like, I don't know.
It's mad. It's mad. And I think it all comes down to the audience that, I mean, the thing about the world of the kind of creator world is that people are drawn to people, right? And so individual people are going to attract other people of a certain ilk, of a certain kind, right? And that one of those characteristics includes audiences of buyers and audiences of non-buyers. There was a very famous case earlier on this year with a company, a big YouTube channel called Yes Theory, who are one of the biggest YouTube channels of all. And they, I don't know how many tens of millions of subscribers they've got. Massive, absolutely massive channel. They launched a course on their first course, I believe, on storytelling. You know, objectively, what a great opportunity to learn from these guys who have built a massive YouTube channel, master storytellers. They launched this course for, I don't know how much it was, like $300 or something. They faced a massive revolt from their audience. How dare you try and sell us a course? What a, you know, you guys are so, like, their audience just burned them alive. And so, you know, why is that? Well, If you think about who the audience is, it's people who are watching for entertainment. They don't have a problem that they're trying to solve, or if they do have problems, this channel is not solving those particular problems. They're not interested. We've worked with, the one particular influencer I can think of, who obviously I won't name, but this influencer had around 5 million YouTube subscribers in a niche that is one of the biggest niches of all. One of the big three, you know, health, wealth, and relationships. By all accounts, you think this is surely a dead cert. We couldn't sell a thing. And the reason was because the particular audience that this person had was demographically just not an audience that is used to buying things. And I can't really say more than that, but it was shocking to see. You know, you normally think, well, the law of large numbers, you get put something in, you get something out, right? Not always at all. It's a real bags of fun.
I think product market fit is fascinating. And I think that lots of people who think that they've figured a thing out were lucky.
I agree.
in a large number of ways. Like, so somebody starts up a YouTube channel or a podcast or whatever, and they put all the work in and it's successful and it builds up, and then they launch the course and the people buy it and they go, that was great. And it's like, it was, and you did lots of hard work, and you were dedicated, and you persevered, and it was emotionally difficult, and you pushed through it, and you learned lots of new skills, and you did all that. But you could have done that, and it not worked. Mm-hmm. What you did not guarantee success by any means. And this definitely applies for me as well. Like, there's a bunch of places where I'm just like, I just keep thinking, oh, I'll figure this thing out in my head, and I try it, and I figure it out in my head, and I'm wrong. And I'm wrong again and again and again. And occasionally I go, what is it that when I just look at what happened to work, or I copy someone who did something that worked before, I go, let me try that. And I do that. I'm like, oh, well, that doesn't make any sense to me why that works. But it does.
I think the reality of regular business is that most of the things you do should be failing. And a small number of things you get right. And then you reorientate the business around the things that you get right. And that's, I think, most entrepreneurs' experience of business. The whole, you know, if you take the broadly the terms creators and courses that creators sell, I think there's a lot other factors as well. Like a lot of people that we know started at a particular moment in time where you could build. It was a lot easier to build large audiences because there was relatively less competition. They also happened to have the right approach of, say, teaching something on YouTube, personality led. They were before their time slightly. Whereas I think what happens now is people get started and there's so much more awareness of what you can do with a YouTube channel, for example, there's a lot easier access to advice and to help. And so people, I don't know whether they're sometimes in more of a rush, or they kind of have, there's an expectation of things to work. And so it may be if something doesn't work right away, there's more of a temptation to jump to something else that might work a little bit better. So I agree that like, luck is a big part of things. But then I guess you could also say that, you know, it's like in the, which was the book by Malcolm Gladwell, where he writes about how Bill Gates, the number of fortunate events that had to conspire for Bill Gates to create Microsoft. You know, he was at the only university in the country that had a computer department where you could access it as a student, and he had he happened to be going to university in that particular year where personal computers were about to take off, and his parents had the money to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, luck accounts for so much, doesn't it? But then I think what's interesting is to see how that develops over time, because luck can get you started, but the mark of an entrepreneur, I think, is whether you continue to learn and you continue to build and to grow. And from the most kind of humbling aspect of that for me has definitely been paid advertising, because however well you may do on the kind of audience building creator side, paid advertising will raise you to the ground pretty quickly, and it's a rude awakening, because you just realize that, you know, all the stuff that you've built simply doesn't work with anyone who hasn't already self-selected as a fan of your content. Simply doesn't work. So then you realize, right, okay, well, if I want to grow, if I want to expand to a paid audience, I have to figure out, I have to actually now, my job is to understand the wider marketplace, and serving the wider marketplace is a very different proposition to serving an audience that you've somehow built.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Ollie, this was awesome. Absolutely love your kind of insights and perspective and all this kind of stuff. If people want to get some more of your wisdom, where else can they go? I know you've got like a case study you could share with people.
Yeah, well, the place to go would be to ollierichards.co, and that's my newsletter. And every week I send out newsletters talking about building education businesses. A lot of the stuff that we've been talking about here, this exact kind of thing. I've also written a 117-page case study of my business, Story Learning. It's completely free. You get it free in a Google Doc when you sign up. And that will show you how my whole business works, how the marketing works, how the structure of the team, how we sell, all of this stuff. It's all there. And you can download that for free. So yeah, just head over to ollierichards.co and grab yourself a copy.
Perfect. And we're going to link your YouTube channel and Twitter in the show notes as well. So if anybody wants to go grab that case study or check out Ollie's YouTube or Twitter, then that'll be in the show notes. If you found this interview useful and you want to get future episodes, please subscribe wherever you've been listening. And thank you, Ollie, so much for coming on. And thank you guys, of course, the most for listening and bearing, listening in for the whole episode. Really appreciate your time. Thanks, guys.